Thank you, Michael, for these kind words. And thank you all for coming here. I'm happy to see many faces. Some of them I know, some of them I don't. And I can see as well some young faces who are the outcome of this research and taking it forward will fall on their shoulders. So I hope I will make a presentation that make them understand the enormity of the problems that we're encountering. This is a slogan that is used by one of the energy supply companies, which actually reflects the state of what's happening now. The 21st century will undoubtedly face a revolution in energy because of the dwindling supplies of fossil fuels and increased greenhouse emissions. A revolution is really an overstatement, in my view, because you cannot really make a revolution in energy, as we will see, because of the complexity of the systems. And I think whatever we do is going to be still a slow evolution. Looking at it probably after a century, it might look like a revolution from the century before, but there's no way that's going to be an overnight change. Many of us might think that renewable energy sources will solve our problems. We are investing in wind. The government is installing 2,000 wind turbines around the coastal areas of UK and offshore wind turbines. Then a few years' time will be sorted out. But the case is not. I'm sorry that about the quality of this, but I'll explain what's this here. We have here the energy usage in Europe, 2010. That's statistics taken from credible sources. And this is the predictions based on the best predictions of what's going on in terms of producing of new energy systems and supplies, et cetera, for 2030. We can see that now only 9.5% of our energy is being used from renewables, which is a mix of wind, solar, biomass, geothermal, solid waste, et cetera. That is going to be, in percentage terms, increased only to 25.2% by 2030. So we will be still relying heavily on using fossil fuels. We can see that there is about 39.9% of our energy is going to be coming from coal and petroleum products. There's some prediction about 25.8% from nuclear. So the use of fossil fuels is going to be with us. In percentage terms, it has reduced slightly from 51% to 39%, but in actual terms, it still will grow slightly. So we need to search for a way of burning fossil fuels cleanly because of the environmental problem that we all know about. This is just a snap from some slogans that they use in the European Commission. This is talking about energy policy, and it can reflect some of the aspects that we're looking at. We are looking at the policy at sustainability, security of supply. This is an enormous problem, so sustainability is not the highest on the agenda. Security of supply is very important, where most of the fossil fuels that we are using nowadays are in areas which are either politically unstable or we have troubles maybe sometimes in the future of getting supplies. And then competitiveness is a very important one because of the world changing nowadays, and a lot of other countries are involved now producing energy systems such as Japan, US, and nowadays Southeast Asia. So we need to be as well competitive because it's not only using the energy, we need to produce systems that use that energy. Now the areas that we need to achieve these policies are energy efficiency, which we've been working on for a long time, renewable energy, which everybody knows about them, but the most important one that I'm going to be talking about today is the decarbonized fossil fuels power. And then nuclear, which is not the subject of this talk. And then many instruments that are going to be used for that, such as the technology push, and then all these items here that you can see here that the politicians use day in and day out in energy. So I'll start by just giving a background of how the energy is generated nowadays using fossil fuels. We can see across the country many of these things dotted around. These are basically the cooling towers for traditional or conventional coal power stations. At conventional coal power station, you just put the coal or sometimes solid waste and you burn it in a boiler producing steam. You throw your flue gases outside with some element of cleaning in the stack, and then that steam is expanded in a steam turbine Then you have here a generator that generates electricity, which gets supplied to our homes or industries. The steam, as after it gets expanded, it gets condensed again and goes back in the cycle, and the cooling tower uses some water really to condense that steam. And then you see these cooling towers here producing some vapor coming outside, which actually this is not really the harmful thing that you can see. It's what comes out of the stack that is harmful to us or our health. Another way of doing it, which is less known to people, is using what we call gas turbines. And I'll explain later in a bit more detail about the gas turbine. But this is a typical gas turbine power station. In this power station, you burn mostly, instead of coal, in the conventional one, either natural gas or some liquid fuels. These come from either storage of oil or you have a pipeline of gas. And the gas is burned after air is being compressed. So you compress air, you burn the gas, and then you expand that gas, and then that expansion produces power that drives your gas turbine. This is a typical gas turbine, and if you go around the countryside, you might see some of those sites looking like this. These are typically smaller in size than the conventional coal power stations, although in the terms of power, they can be comparable. Now, I will explain why these will become a more, if you like, seen thing than the conventional coal power stations. But to explain this, I will start by looking at schematic diagrams because it makes it much more easier to understand. A typical gas turbine is made up of very simple components. We just have a compressor and a turbine connected on a single shaft, then to a generator. And the way it works basically is the air enters the compressor increases the pressure of air. You need that increase of the pressure of air before you burn it with the fuel, because this is how you get high efficiency of the system. And then the fuel can come in into the combustion chamber, you burn that, you end up with high temperature, high pressure gases that expand in the turbine, producing high amount of power. This power, some of it used to drive the compressor, but a lot of remaining power is what drives our electricity generator. So this is a conventional or simple schematic of a gas turbine. And the fuels nowadays in power generation mostly used in these gas turbines are natural gas, basically. Gas turbines are really actually not what we use only for power generation. What you have in a conventional jet propulsion, whether a military engine or a civil engine, is the same concept. It's a gas turbine. You have a compressor. Here in the front, you have a combustion chamber, a turbine, and then a jet in the back that provides you with the propulsion. A gas turbine for power generation is a similar device. You can have what we call micro gas turbine. Inside this box, is produced by an American company, which actually provides for homes or small businesses a combination of power, electricity, and the hot gases coming out of it can be used for heating the home, or can be used as well for providing what we call absorption cooling. So it can be used for many things. But you can as well miniaturize those. So these are very tiny gas turbines that have been developed nowadays at MIT. They are not available commercially at the moment, but the objective is to replace a lot of devices that use batteries, for example, mobile phone batteries or laptop batteries. These are supposed to be working much longer than normal batteries. You can work 20 hours on one of those devices on a simple cartridge of fuel. And usually they're not noisy. You might think that these devices are hardly any noisier than a laptop fan. So gas turbines are with us all over. Now, to get maximum efficiency out of a gas turbine, typically when you have a gas turbine running, you end up with the gases, because of the thermodynamics of the cycle, which I'm not going to go in detail of. The gases coming out of it are still very hot, typically about 600-700 degrees, sometimes 800 degrees C. So there's a lot of energy that would get wasted. So in a conventional power station, we use what we call a combined cycle. So these hot gases cannot be expanded any further because they're at atmospheric pressure. So instead of wasting that energy, we use these hot gases to raise steam again using a boiler, so it becomes like a steam power station, and then you have another steam turbine. And that steam turbine drives another generator, so instead of wasting that heat, you are taking it to another electricity supply. And this cycle, we call it a combined cycle, and most of the power stations nowadays operate what we call the combined cycle. Right. we can take this further and use different fuel. In a gas turbine, I said we can use natural gas. But what happens if you don't have natural gas? Most of our indigenous resources in this country and in Europe are coal. So we actually can still use the gas turbine by gasifying that fuel. Sorry. If you can gasify that fuel using what we call a gasifier, and I'll talk a little bit about more gasification process. But in this particular cycle, you take some of that steam coming out of here instead of expanding it, and you feed it in a gasifier. You feed into your coal or solid waste, and then you raise a gas. The gas that comes out basically is primarily hydrogen-rich syngas, and I'll talk about that in more detail. And that hydrogen-rich syngas at the moment in existing power station get mixed with natural gas and gets burned. You cannot really burn hydrogen-rich syngas as it is because of problems that I will explain later. So this is what we called integrated gasification combined cycle. So this is a complete system where you have gasification. Gasification uses actually the power from the actual turbine, and you got electricity coming out of that. Of course, there is a penalty that comes up out of that process, but we want to see the advantages that allow us to do that. So this is a schematic diagram. A more detailed diagram of a similar station looks like that. So it contains a lot more components. So it's not as simple as that. So for example, after the gas, the syngas comes out, you need to go through a lot of process of cleaning up. Sometimes you need to do carbon removal. If you want air coming into the system here, you need to, sometimes you can separate it, so remove the oxygen and put it in the gasifier, take the nitrogen and feed it back to dilute the syngas coming into the turbine. So it's a quite an enormous and elaborate process. And this is only one cycle. There is a large number of cycles being derived, developed by different companies nowadays which use similar systems like those. Right. So this chart, I'm not sure whether you can see the numbers, but I'll read most of them if you can't. This tells us why people are going towards IGCC, or Integrated Gasification Combined Cycle. The most modern coal-fired power stations, or the power stations that you just burn coal directly, we call them supercritical pulverized coal plants. So these are the most efficient ones. And this is a comparison between emissions of these types of power stations and the integrated gasification cycles. And I have here a percent reduction of these emissions. For example, carbon monoxide is a very harmful emission that comes out of power stations. There's an 82.2% reduction if you use IGCC plant compared to a traditional power station. Nitric oxides, which are responsible for acid rain and all these types of problems, they are reduced by 24.9%. Sulfur dioxide, 71.8%. Mercury is reduced by 66.7%. There's a 97.8% reduction in fluorides, which are harmful to the ozone layer. And then sulfur, sulfuric acid mist reduced by 90.2%. And particulate materials, which are, again, harmful for health when they enter the lungs, their reduction of 58.1%. So there's a compelling argument that IGCC plants are much more user-friendly for people in terms of environmental impact. Economic impact is a different issue that we need to look at. This is a typical IGCC plant, which I used a lot of the data during our research to get numbers from it and make the case for some research proposal. This is a plant available in the Netherlands, in Buggenham, and it uses actually a mixture of coal and solid waste as a fuel, but at the moment it has to be diluted by natural gas, as we will see later. So how do we do the gasification? I just mentioned briefly gasification. There's a large number of devices nowadays, different technologies for gasifying coal or solid waste. But the primary concept here is to mix the solid waste with oxygen or air and steam, and you fire it slightly. Now, the energy that you fire it here is not as much as the energy you fire coal. It's only less than 20%. So you need just some energy, some heat. It acts as a shift reaction. You are only transferring the energy in the coal into hydrogen. Hydrogen becomes an energy carrier. So it's like you basically storing the energy from coal into another device. But during that process, you are still wasting some energy. So there's some heat released here, which you can utilize. So you can have heat recovery system in the middle. But after that, you have to have gas cleanup because the coal or the solid waste that comes in is not pure carbon. It's got a lot of other material that might burn or might become volatile. So you have to have a cleanup operation here behind, and then you end up with what we call syngas or synthetic gas. Syngas is primarily made in terms of fuel of H2 and CO, both of them combustible, but you have a large amount of CO2. But this process actually provides a good concept for some technology. I'm just putting here a simple chemical reaction, but actually the shift reaction contains a lot more in terms of the chemistry, which is not really the subject of this lecture. So I'm giving basically here a broad view of what is a gasifier. Right. Now, moving on. So I said why the fact that the hydrogen and carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide in the syngas provide an opportunity, because if you can collect the carbon dioxide before you burn the syngas, then you have a fuel burning without carbon dioxide coming out of it. So we call that pre-capture technology. You can have a pre-capture or you can have a post-capture technology. If you burn natural coal, you cannot capture the carbon dioxide first. You have to capture it after you have burned it, right? So nowadays, there is a process of capturing carbon dioxide and getting rid of it. And these are different technologies. You can, from a power station, capture the carbon dioxide and bury it in depleted oil wells. You can use it for enhanced recovery from deep oil wells. You can bury it in unminable coal beds. There is unminable coal beds where the coal is distributed over a wide area where you can't mine it, so you can bury it in there. Or it can be done in some saline formations in the ground. Or you can do what we call ocean sequestration, so you can bury it under the ocean. So there's different ways of getting rid of the carbon dioxide. The technology is being developed and is being tested over a wide range of power stations across Europe and in the US and Japan at the moment. A lot of the evidence shows that we can bury that carbon dioxide and it's not going to leak for thousands of years to come. So maybe a very, very long time, future generations might have to deal with it, but not in the foreseeable future. What is the concept of getting rid of carbon dioxide? You have carbon dioxide, you need to take it out of the fuel. The concept is relatively simple. I'm not here trying to say this is half empty, half full cup, which many people use in their presentation. This is the principle basically behind it is like basic carbon dioxide dissolving, or the gas dissolving in a soft drink. So you can pass the gases containing the carbon dioxide inside water. The carbon dioxide gets absorbed. Then the carbon dioxide gets released, and the rest of the gases can stay or can be released under other temperatures later. So you can release that carbon dioxide, take it, compress it, put it in a pipeline, and get rid of it. And with this, you end up with carbon-free burning. The process in reality is much more complex. So this is a typical schematic from one of the power generation companies showing the process of CO2 capture, which contains a large flow diagram here of various processes before you can get rid of the carbon dioxide. It's not important, the details, but I'm just trying to show that how involved is the process, and it's a very costly process, and we'll see the cost added to the process of power generation. So recapping on the concepts of carbon capture, we have two technologies. One, we call it a pre-capture, which has to have a gas turbine, because we gasify the solid waste or the coal. We take the carbon dioxide first, and then we generate the power, and then the CO2 captured, is you get rid of it directly. Or you can have what we call it, this is the post-capture. You capture it behind, and this is the pre-capture, where you have the gas turbine and you capture beforehand. Now, the two technologies are different in terms of cost and in terms of operation. And this diagram shows the cost of capture between the two different ones. This is the additional cost on electricity generation due to the carbon capture. If you are using IGCC or pre-capture technology, you're looking at about $100 per megawatt of electricity generated, while you're looking at about 15% increase if you have supercritical pulverized coal power stations. Both of them have an additional cost, but you can see as well. So there's two advantages that we saw from the IGCC plants. There's a lot less emissions, but the carbon capture technology is much, or relatively cheaper. Right. We are not out of this. In the UK, there's a number of power stations has been identified by European Commissions for funding to test the technology of carbon capture and storage. And the UK have won this plant, which is being built in Hatfield. The work on this one started in 2010 and is due for completion in 2015. And it was selected as a demonstration plant under the EU Energy Recovery Program. The cost of these power stations is enormous. You're looking at about an investment of about £1.5 billion pounds for this for the rated power of 900 megawatt electric. Right. So now coming back to syngas. Syngas, when it has been cleaned, taking carbon dioxide out of it, typically contains about 80% hydrogen. The remaining is carbon monoxide and some other pollutant that you cannot remove. Right, so what are the properties of hydrogen? Why can't you just burn hydrogen straight away? Hydrogen is a lot different from natural gas. We cannot just bring it in and burn it in a gas turbine, as simple as that. This is some of the comparisons that we have. In terms of density, the hydrogen is much lighter, right, compared to carbon monoxide and compared to methane. Natural gas is predominantly methane, or most of the, if you like, natural gas contained methane or similar chains. So there's a huge difference between this and that in terms of density, which means that the volume flow rate that you want to put into the gas turbine would be completely different. The other thing is the energy density. Energy density for hydrogen is a lot lower than methane. Right, these are just broad bad comparisons, and these are taken at a particular temperature. When the energy density is much lower, you'll imagine you have a gas turbine, you need to produce the same power, you need to pump a lot of hydrogen in it to produce that same power. And that's where the problem starts. The other problem is the speed of ignition or combustion. Hydrogen burns about 10 times faster than carbon dioxide, monoxide or methane. It's a very fast burning, so the flame develops very quickly. The control of the flame, the process is the technology that comes with it is very difficult to achieve. Right, so this is where we started work on that. And the work started through what we call the European Turbine Network. The European Turbine Network is an association that brings together stakeholders with an interest in gas turbine technology. This institution is based in Brussels. And it has a broad representation across what we call the value chain, research institutions, engine manufacturer, OEMs, and it's got in it energy providers, etc. So it's a network that provides the whole value chain. And the intent is to optimize the gas turbine technology and develop and find suitable ways of doing research and development. I've been involved with this association since I joined Sussex in 2006, and I'm been the chairman of what we call the Cycle Efficiency Technology Committee in that association. I'm still the chairman of that committee till now. And through hard work over about a period of 2 years, we, with a team from industry and from gas or energy providers and from various small manufacturers in Europe of various systems, we came up with what we call a position paper in August 2007. These position papers, if you like, they are used as something that put a pressure on the European Commission to push a certain technology. And that position paper, the aim of it was to highlight the necessary research and demonstration needs that emerge from the technology to needed to reduce CO2 emissions. And we found that the pre-combustion capture, which I demonstrated for, applied to reduce CO2 and the gas turbine, and the gas turbine technology that able to burn undiluted syngas. Undiluted means that we are not going to mix it with anything else. With a high proportion of hydrogen, requires a lot of research. So this is the if you like the spirit of that paper, and I'm going just to take some items of it and show the challenges. The challenge of global climate change has become incontestable. Some people might argue otherwise, which calls for a drastic reduction of CO2 emissions in the coming decades. And then the undisputable thing is carbon capture and storage, or CCS, has developed as a promising technology to significantly reduce CO2 emissions. However, pre-combustion CO2 capture requires the combustion of hydrogen-rich fuels, as I have demonstrated, in gas turbines. In addition, energy security considerations in Europe, and that's another important parameter, urge stakeholders to increase the use of indigenous fuel sources. And the indigenous fuel sources in Europe are coal and biomass. We don't have much gas. We don't have oil. So various blends of alternative fuels with natural gas as well can be used. This requires increased fuel flexibility of gas turbines. So we can't just burn natural gas. We need to introduce other fuels in the gas turbines. And some technologies developed by gas turbine manufacturers currently, as the Buggenham one that I saw, they burn what we call diluted syngas. So the benefit, the whole benefit is not realized from that. There's no generally available low emissions technology to enable operation with undiluted hydrogen-rich syngas. And in order to contribute viable solutions to energy supply and greenhouse gas emissions reduction, further gas turbine research and demonstration is essential for the for these kinds of gases. Right. So the drivers behind the technology is, we know that, and some of the statistics I've shown, that over 24% of the world's power still comes from coal and is going to be still coming from coal. By 2030, 20% of European electricity generation is expected to come from coal, and this is another important driver. Natural gas prices are expected to increase and expected to fluctuate for that matter because of market pressures. EU dependence on imported energy is expected to increase from 50% to 65% by 2030, which is a dangerous situation to be in. IGCC, which is what I demonstrated, Integrated Gasification Combined Cycle Plant, is significantly cleaner than coal-powered power stations. And IGCC with carbon capture and storage produce near zero emissions, which is an important target to achieve. All right. So after a hard work of 2 years, we managed to push the European Commission to produce a call for proposals for this particular technology. This was not available at the beginning of Framework 7 first set of calls. So it was a number of us who went and met several times with European Commission experts and managed to convince them that this is a technology that needs to be looked after. And finally, they got convinced and a call came out. We gathered a consortium of 24 partners, and Sussex was a leader of one of major 4 work packages in that program, which I led that work. And we managed to get funding in 2009 of €17 million to develop the technology, which I'm going to explain a little bit later. So the project finally started after a lot of wrangling and legal processes in 2010, November 2010. So this is the logo of the project, and we call it now H2IGCC, Energy Without CO2. And the title of the project, basically, Low Emission Gas Turbine Technology for Hydrogen-Rich Syngas. So this is funded by European Commission, and we are a major partner of that project, and I sit in the steering committee of the project. The objectives of the project is to provide and demonstrate technical solutions which will allow the use of state-of-the-art, highly efficient, reliable gas turbine in the next generation of IGCC plant, suitable for combusting undiluted hydrogen-rich syngas with low NOx and also allowing high fuel flexibility. Where does this position us? There is parallel research happening in Japan and similar research happening in the US at the same time. We believe that our project is more ambitious. They are looking at the moment in the US, for example, for having up to 50% hydrogen-rich fuel. We are looking at up to 80%. So these are much more stringent and ambitious targets than even our competitors in the field. Right. So the vision is to pave the way for the commercial deployment of efficient, clean, flexible, and reliable IGCC plants with carbon capture and storage by 2020. 2020 is a significant year. And if anybody didn't hear by the European Commission slogan, they like those slogans, they call 20-20-20, which is reduction of carbon emissions by 20% and renewables 20% by year 2020. So they use that lots of 20s. It looks very nice thing to follow. So the project structure, and this as well resulted from a large amount of work ahead of the launch of this project, is made out of five SPs, means sub-programs. So we have the combustion, which is a major package. We know that the combustion technology is an essential to get this going. We need some materials to deal with the new gases coming out in the exhaust. I'm not going to talk in the details of that because it's not the subject of my package. My work package here is the turbo machinery work package, and it's led by Sussex. We've got three other partners in Europe in it, and some of my colleagues who are working on this project are here, and I'll have to acknowledge their contribution to this work. And then there is system analysis, which is looking at the system where this gas turbine sits. So this is the gas turbine we're looking at. Our work in the turbo machinery means our work is looking at the compressor and the turbine in the back. So dealing with these two components is our major research and how we deal with hydrogen-rich syngas gas. And I will talk about the problems associated. These are the partners involved. So we have a wide contribution from many European countries, industries. We can, for example, notably here see the biggest manufacturer of industrial gas turbines in Europe, Siemens. Here we got many of the gas provider, EDF, for example, here a number of UK universities. And different European universities, DLR from Germany. So there's a big consortium of industry and research institutions in the project. So there are many challenges. The challenges that we're going to solve are in combustion, challenges in turbo machinery, challenges in materials, and challenges over system optimization. The combustion challenges, as I said earlier, is there's no combustion technology at the moment available able to burn hydrogen-rich syngas because of the speed of reaction and because of the controllability of the flames during that process. So I'm not going to go in detail on that because it's not my type. The turbo machinery work package, or the turbo machinery part, there's two primary problems which I'll talk about, we're going to try to deal with. The materials has to do with materials that are durable. These gas turbines are made to live for something like 50 years. They're very costly. You're talking about a gas turbine of a standard size nowadays, a few hundred megawatt, you're looking about tens, if not approaching £100 million cost. The big investment with the whole system around it, you're looking about a cost approaching £1 billion. So when you build those power stations, you expect your system to last for something like 50 years. But it's not the system as well. The system has to come with a lot of value chain around it. There is companies which work on servicing, on supplying parts, on cleaning the system. It has to be cleaned online. So there's a lot of large number of smaller and smaller companies running around to get that system working. So when you design a system like that, you cannot really just do, if you like, a revolutionary change. You have to do an evolutionary change where all these systems around you or companies can adapt to the changes that are happening. Now, challenges with the compressor. The compressor typically is made out of a large number of rotating and stationary blades. Typical size, as you can see, of a compressor of a gas turbine like this. The compressor is this part, as I showed in the schematic before. What we need the compressor for, we need to compress the air before we use it for mixing with the fuel for burning. It's essential to compress the air, otherwise you don't get efficient process. The gas turbine efficiency is directly proportional to the pressure ratio or the compression ratio. The more you compress, the more you get efficiency. If you don't efficient compressor, you might not get any power output useful out of the whole gas turbine. Now, this is what we call a compressor characteristic, and I'm not expecting you to understand all the details of that, but typically we plot the compressor characteristic of mass flow rate flowing it against pressure ratio. And this is what we call the operation range. So the compressor can surge in this area if you raise the pressure ratio, or can what we call it choke in this area. So you have only to operate within this envelope. Now the problem when you start pumping in hydrogen in the combustion chamber, At the back of the compressor, the pressure rises because you're pumping a lot of fuel there. The turbine would be clogged with fuel and with gases, and the pressure rises. If the pressure rises, it would raise the pressure of the compressor, and you end up operating in this zone. So you end up with instability, right? Or what we call a surge, and that's not going to function. You could say easily, okay, why don't we design just a compressor that's it here? But the problem that we're encountering is we need fuel flexibility. If you have a gasifier, which contains a huge amount of technology and very expensive, you can typically have one gasifier within a power station. If that gasifier breaks down or any subsystem breaks down during a process, you cannot stop generating electricity. So the backup is to fire natural gas. You have a storage of natural gas. During the process of repairs or maintenance, you have to fire natural gas. So we need a compressor which operates in here, but when the gasifier breaks down, we have automatically to shift down here. And that's a major challenge, just one of the major challenges that we're facing. We have not solved that. We have about 2.5 years left in the project to be able to solve that problem, but this is what we're working on at the moment. Right. The turbine have other sets of problems. When you burn hydrogen, the exhaust gases are mostly water vapor. Water vapor have a much higher heat capacity than usual carbon dioxide, which is the natural product of burning carbon dioxide. Higher heat capacity means that the thermal system here in the turbine completely different. The cooling technology has to be different because these turbines has to be cooled. For a turbine to operate very efficiently, as we will see, it needs to operate at a very high temperature. You start from a high temperature, and the whole cycle would be, if you like, the whole engine would be much smaller because you can produce, if what you call it specific power, it's much higher when you have a very high turbine inlet temperature. Now, to achieve that high turbine inlet temperature, sometimes you have the temperature of the gases coming out of the turbine are higher than the melting point of the components. So we use what we call cooling technology. So you can blow air, which sometimes drawn out of the compressor, into inside the blades, in some blades, or you can have little holes coming out of the turbine blades, and they create a thin film of cold air around the blades to protect it from melting and from the hot gases and the hot environment. Now, the problem is this technology has been optimized for temperature distributions and for enthalpy drops, which are compatible with syngas. With natural gas. When you have hydrogen-rich fuel with a lot of water vapor, the technology has to be completely revised. So this is another large part of our project that we're working on. In Sussex, we are working on the structural integrity of those blades when the syngas comes, because some of our other partners are working on the cooling passages and on the actual geometry of those turbine blades. Right. So, from that, the challenges in the turbo machinery we have, increased fuel mass flow rate, lead to compressor instability and mismatch between the compressor and the turbine, increased operating temperatures and higher heat will result in basically higher demand for cooling. And that creates a lot of problem for us. So compressor research at Sussex, the objective of it is to find a new compressor blade shape and arrangements for efficient gas turbine operation with hydrogen-rich syngas to allow for fuel flexibility where we can switch momentarily back to natural gas operation in the event of gasifier failure. We also need to ensure the integrity of the system in both extreme conditions. The system has to operate without surge, without choke, without any vibrations. I will talk a little bit about why the compressor design is so complicated and difficult. This is a typical compressor. The compressor, just a single, we call it blade row or rotor of those. The air comes at a certain angle here. This is a relative to the blade because the blade typically comes that way and the blade is rotating. So anybody sitting with the blade will see the air coming in that angle. And the blade shaped like an aerofoil, like an aircraft wing. So you get a pressure side and a suction side, high pressure on one side, low pressure on another side, and because of rotation and the pressure difference, you create what we call torque. The torque times that rotation is basically what gives the power to the gas and the pressure. So the gas gets energy, kinetic energy from these rotating blades, and this kinetic energy is converted to static pressure by what we call nozzle guide vanes after that. Now, because of the, I'm taking cutout through those and looking at through those blades, these blades rotating in that direction. And typically, because of the heavy weight of the casing is not attached to the blade, so there's a gap here. That provides a very complex flow pattern here. We have what we call boundary layers near the blades where the flow is slow. We have very fast flow in the middle. We have slow flow near the hub section here or the bottom of it, and we have slow flow here. That provides the mixture of fast and slow flow produces recirculations here. But more importantly, because we have of the rotation, high pressure this side, low pressure this side, some of the air would leak on top of these, creating as well some extra recirculations. So all these complex flow features conspire to produce a very complex system to design and produce an optimum flow in it, right? And it's very difficult to imagine that you can optimize that system by cut and try. You need to understand the aerodynamics, and you need numerical tools which allow you to design that. And this is where the research that I've been working on for about 15 years comes in. The other features of that compressor is the shock waves. The first few stages of the compressors operate at what we call a transonic speeds. The Mach numbers or the flow speed is higher relative to the plates, is higher than the speed of sound. If it's higher than the speed of sound, you end up with shock waves. Shock waves are sometimes beneficial because they provide pressure rise, but sometimes they have caused problems because they do losses. The flow loses energy as it crosses the shock waves. So we need to optimize between the benefit and the problem that we get between those shock waves by understanding clearly the aerodynamics and finding tools to predict how the aerodynamics of those blades behave. Another feature is the stability. If your air coming at a favorable angle to the compressor here, which is a mixture of the angle of rotation and the angle of the flow coming in, you end up with a smooth flow coming around the blade. We call that, it's like an aerodynamic shape. But if you have any mismatch in the design, you end up with what we call separation. That separation causes what we call stall. Sometimes you end up with stall cells rotating around and end up as well, sometimes the stall causes surge, the flow coming back out of the front of the compressor. And if the combustion chamber is firing, you could end up having fire coming out of the front, burning the whole device. So stability is actually an important safety factor in the compressor. Right. So I've been working over many years in a tools called computational fluid dynamics. We see that the fluid dynamics problems or the aerodynamics of the system is essential. We have developed what we call computational fluid dynamics tools. These has been developed with me since the time as I was at the Imperial College, and then we have now a tool at Sussex which has been developing as well further, and this allows us to predict the flow behavior in the turbo machinery, in the compressor blades. This is one of the unique tools that commercial softwares cannot predict as efficient as we can do with these tools. So we have a program called SERF, suite of programs, and these allow us to, if you like, do like a virtual test. Instead of putting your compressor in a wind tunnel or in a test rig and run and make noise like what typically do in the thermofluids, you can do it in a computer without much noise and with much less cost and predict what goes on. Right, we do like a virtual test really, so you can really reduce the amount of test rigs that you do or the amount of engine tests significantly. That doesn't eliminate the need for test rigs, so I'm not saying close down the thermofluids because we still need the experiments to validate these CFD tools. We still need the experiment to test the final product of the result, right? So this is basically an integral part of the research. You have to have your experiment going line in line with your computational work. So this is my test rig. We have this computing clusters that we have at thermofluids. There are we have 96 processors, 96 computing nodes, which allow us to do very fast computations in a very short period of time. The investment has been on this for a while, but the H2 IGC project provided a significant investment in buying this equipment. Now, how does the system work? You start from a geometry. This is, for example, a geometry of a compressor. You create what we call a numerical grid, so you discretize your geometry to small points in space, and you solve the flow equations, or you transform your continuum flow equation to what we call discrete flow equations, and you solve millions and millions of equations at every node, at all the nodes in space to find out the flow distribution. So optimizing that process is that takes long time to develop and get through. And then from that, you can get your final test result, which you can see similar to what you get from experiments. For example, these are some of the results, and some of my students would recognize these because they produced these results recently. So you can see here a comparison between experimental data and predicted compressor characteristic, and we can see that this CFD tool can provide us with something similar to the experiment. And this as well shows us the complex flow features near the tip of a compressor with shock waves and flow leaking over the tip, etc. And these are some flow profiles. So these are what is the basic research we do, trying to find solutions in a virtual reality. And once this is optimized, we take it to the real application. Right. This is some of the results that we obtained recently on the preliminary geometry that we have designed for the H2 IGCC compressor. So this is a quite large compressor. It contains 15 stages, and it takes about 800 kilograms per second of air, right? So it's quite a huge device, and it takes a huge amount of air that's swallowed. I mean, if you imagine what is 800 kilograms per second, if you take it at normal atmospheric conditions, normal atmospheric pressure and temperature, the amount of air would fill the Brighton stadium that we see across the road. So a huge amount of air that's sucked in that compressor in a second. And it needs to be compressed, and the compression ratio for that compressor is 20 to 1. So you end up with about almost 21, about 18 atmospheric pressure at the end of that compressor. So these are showing just some of the flow solutions around the blade. Some of the blades here were showing the shock waves across them, and we're still in the process of working on that. This is the first preliminary compressor geometry that we have designed at Sussex with some of our partners in Italy. So this is a preliminary geometry that has been produced as a baseline geometry. This is not the final geometry that we are going to use for the compressor. So this is optimized using natural gas. Once we start with that, then we're going to start modifying it to see how we can get it to work with hydrogen-rich fuels. Right. Just as a final point, I'm going to talk about a slightly different research. We saw a lot of waste heat in the systems that we do, and this is a new research that we're going to start as well on what we call waste heat recovery using organic Rankine cycle. This is a research program that we won the funding from EPSRC with a company called Efficient Air, and I must acknowledge the support from the Mike Wild, who's sitting there and getting that project. These are the type of units that you use to recover waste heat at low temperatures. If you have, for example, a system which is operating at a house or a small industrial institution where the temperature coming out of that system about 100 or 200 degrees C, you cannot raise steam from that, and you cannot use that heat practically. So the way that people use that is you use similar to system that utilize geothermal energy systems. Right. So this is a system like that, and it uses what we call organic fluid. It's pretty much like a fridge, a refrigeration system, but a reversed one. So you instead of compressing, providing energy to the refrigeration system, here you get the energy out of it. So there's a working fluid here, and we're using organic fluids because CFCs are harmful to the ozone layer if they leak out. The problem is most of the systems that are available in the market nowadays, which are sold either in US and Italy, are about 100 kilowatts or more. A market research shows that there's only about 30 customers who have that amount of waste energy that can be utilized in the UK. If you try to manufacture systems are smaller, under 25 kilowatt, there's enormous technological challenges, but the number of customers would become in the order of thousands. So you have an enormous potential of recovering waste energy if you have that. So our project aims at developing units under 25 kilowatts, possibly 10 kilowatts, that can produce, using this organic cycle, recover the waste heat from energy systems. And with that, I thank you all, and I'll take any questions.